was probably talking about those things. Here I wouldn't doubt about his first visit with Srila Prabhupada to the then Soviet Union in 1971. And of course, it was Srila Prabhupada who, like he did everywhere, who planted the seeds. And just as he went to the West and planted the seeds of bhakti and devotion in the hearts of the most unlikely persons, and with them, and later used them for spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world, Srila Prabhupada in 1971 went to the then Soviet Union, and with Shyama Sundar and I can't remember, Aravind, yes, the three of them. And Prabhupada, as Shyama Sundar Prabhu once presented it when we were having the 25th anniversary, I think it was in 2000. What year was the 25th anniversary in Moscow? When Shyama Sundar came, when there was a big festival, you were there? Oh, you weren't there for that. What was that? Was it 1996? Yeah, it was the 25th, so it must have been 1996. And, no, it was the 40th, excuse me, it was the 40th anniversary. That's right, in 2011. Yes, that's right. He was also there for the 25th. We had a big, in a big hall, huge hall, and that's when he broke down crying. He literally broke down crying in 1996 when he had the 25th anniversary in Moscow, and it was his first time there since then. And when he saw a huge crowd, it was a theater, Oktyabr, Moscow theater. It was, I can't remember how many seats. But it was filled with devotees, and he just said, I just cannot, who would have ever known? I mean, looked at this, and who would have ever known 25 years ago to see all these bright, enthusiastic, and he just started crying, you know, seeing all the devotees. But we had another festival, the 40th anniversary, and in 2011. And it was during that time when Shyama Sundar gave a lot of detail about his 1971 visit with Prabhupada. And he even used I remember the word that he used, that Prabhupada, because he had been Prabhupada's secretary for quite some time, he knew that if Prabhupada didn't get preaching opportunities, he even used the word, he gets a little antsy. Meaning that he was just using that. He says he has to preach. If he's someplace, and of course, when he went to Moscow in 1971, it was exclusively to meet, the purpose was to meet Professor Katovsky, the Indologist in Moscow, who had invited him, and Prabhupada had to kind of stick to the, you know, to the setting as it was set out for him. But Prabhupada wasn't going to, you can't, as Shyama Sundar said, you can't keep Prabhupada down. And he knew they had to go out and find people to bring to Prabhupada. And he even went to, he said he even went to meet Solzhenitsyn. He went out to his place outside the city in an attempt to try to get him to come and convince him to come and meet Prabhupada. And who's a well-known author, who's written the Gulag Archipelago and The Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, the very, very popular books that he had written about the Soviet regime. But he wasn't able to get him to come, but he did meet these two boys when he was out getting vegetables for Prabhupada. And one of them was Anatoly, another was an Indian boy, I guess, whose father was working in the embassy. And he brought these boys approached him and asked him some question, you know, that they saw he was from the West, and asked him, if anybody, I think he asked him if he had any genes or something like that, because the things were very, yeah. Huh? Beatles records, yeah. Yeah, because the communist regime at that time said there are three things that will destroy, in the early days, that will destroy communism. It was rock and roll. It was what? Coca-Cola? And then, of course, in due course of time, it was Hare Krishna. But anyways, he brought those boys back, and we know the history is already known. Prabhupada, and one boy he saw, this Anatoly, who later became Ananta Shanti. Prabhupada just preached to him in the hotel room all day long. And then he came back the next day, and Prabhupada just invested everything in this one boy, of which I'm sure Mondakini will tell us a little bit about, because that was the reason why she went to the Soviet Union, because of Ananta Shanti. And from Ananta Shanti, from this one boy, he risked his life. He literally risked his life going around the Soviet Union without any books, nothing, but with just firm faith in his meeting with Srila Prabhupada. And started the Krishna Consciousness Movement. So Prabhupada again planted the seed in a place which was totally devoid of what to speak of Krishna Consciousness, all forms of God Consciousness. In fact, when I started to go to the Soviet Union during the Soviet times, devotees used to tell me stories how as children they used to have to, they had to see movies that were shown in school about the... Were you subject to these things also? Devotees, I know, told you some of the things they used to see during the communist times. So they used to see movies of priests being beheaded and things like that. It was part of the indoctrination, that at least, that, you know, stay away from God. this could be you. And they told me some, I remember some harrowing stories I used to hear. So, anyways, yes, they were risking their lives. And therefore, many devotees, and in the early days of Krishna consciousness in the Soviet Union, they were literally risking their lives. I mean, to have the control of all forms of publication and things like that was strictly controlled by the government. Even the copy machines were controlled by the government, and devotees, of course, at that time, they started a bootleg printing press in the basement of one devotee's home. And I know this devotee very well. He was telling me, he said, "Maharaj, you know, if they ever found that press in my home, you know, it is probably only one thing that would have been done, is that would have been my execution." And those were the risks that they were taking. And a lot of these things were brought out in the drama Salted Bread that you put on here. So it's no need for me to go on and give the details. They're already well known. But I only started off in this way to emphasize the point that to look at me as somebody who's a pioneer of the Soviet preaching would be a misrepresentation. I came in during communist times, but many before me risked their lives. They risked their lives. I risked, I mean, a few things. I mean, there was some risk. I risked getting caught by KGB, which I did get caught. But even then, I didn't expect that they would do anything except deport me or blacklist me. I never felt in any way that, you know, I would be sent to a gulag if they caught me. So there were risks involved, for sure. And I have a few stories to tell of some of the potential risks that I encountered. But I never at any point was thinking that my life was in jeopardy, as sometimes it has been presented. And maybe it was, but I definitely wasn't thinking that way. Maybe I was just totally naive of what they would have done if they really wanted to do something with me. but I can't say it was austere. It was very austere. I mean, very austere. Some of the austerities I had to go through, when I think about it now, I don't know if I could have, if I could go through them again. Well, it was an adventure also, but it was austere. The living conditions, the weather. And I remember also, I remember going, because during those days, I used to have to go on a tour with a tour group. And that was the only way you could get into the Soviet Union at that time as a foreigner, unless you had a special invitation. You could get in as a tourist, and you had to be part of a tour group, and you would travel with a tour group, with your tour guide, who, and all the tour guides were agents, because that's how they kept track of all the people coming into the country. And every tour that went into the country, they had their representatives in different places in the world who would bring the tour into the Soviet Union, and they would liaise between one another. You would have your, we had our American tour guide who was in charge of our tour group, and we would come in, and then they would meet with the in-tours guide from the Soviet Union, and they would plan our trip for the amount, whatever amount of time we would visit. So, yes, I was being watched. That was there. I was being watched. And I have a few stories to tell on that connection. But the risks were just the austerities involved. Is, for instance, when we would stay in the hotels, I was warned at that time, don't ever talk anything that would lead people to suspect the purpose that you're in the Soviet Union. And Kirti Raj Prabhu, who was actually the GBC of the Soviet Union at that time, gave me strict instructions during my first trip that never to speak openly in the hotels, because all the hotels are bugged, all the rooms are bugged, everywhere you go it's bugged. And he said they even have these things that they could aim at a window and listen to conversations behind the windows. So we had to, he gave us a system for speaking in codes, like Japa. You know, we had these different words that we used to, and for programs and things like that. Because I went with another person. That's another story I have to tell also. But, and I used to have to do the program sometimes either in the middle of the night, because during the day I had to be with the tour, or sometimes very, very early in the mornings. And I had to chant my japa. This is one of the austerities. I had to chant my japa. I used to go, have to go out into the subway, into the metro, and I would be on the subways going back and forth throughout Moscow and Leningrad, chanting my japa, because I couldn't chant in the hotel, and I couldn't chant outside because it was minus 25 degrees. So I would just go in the subways, and I would just go back and forth in the subways, and that's where I would chant my japa in the morning. So that was part of the austerity. And other part of the austerity was living in hotels. To go into the details of those austerities, I think wouldn't even be appropriate, but the hotels were definitely very austere, small little rooms, like no bigger than closets, which we had to pay $200 a night for to stay in the hotels. And it was just part of the austerity of going to the Soviet Union and getting the opportunity to, which I felt at the time was to serve Prabhupada's desire. And one of the things that I noticed, and especially in the Soviet times, we look at the expansion of the preaching of the Soviet Union today, but I used to oftentimes think during those early visits that one thing that communism did for the Soviet people is it created a very fertile field for spreading Krishna consciousness. I found it that way, an extremely fertile field for spreading Krishna consciousness, because the people had an innate propensity, you know, to accept the existence of something beyond. And many of them, of course, for them, they just wanted to know what was beyond, you know, the Soviet regime. If it came from outside the Soviet Union, in the minds of many people, it was divine. And that was how I first experienced my early days, that many people would come very, very eager to hear anything that was coming from outside the Soviet Union. But in due course of time, I began to realize that because they were so suppressed, that desire to want to know about the existence of the divinity beyond, you know, the Communist Party, which they always tried to keep the people under control, they were very, very eager to hear, and they would sit in those early days. I would actually, the programs used to be sometimes 6 hours, you know, lectures. They just wouldn't let me go. And they were usually in a flat. Sometimes we had to have programs in the forest. And my first visit in the Soviet Union, actually, just recently, I think it was last year, one devotee came up to me and he handed me a CD and said, "Maharaj, I have something you might be interested in." He said, "I took videos in your forest program that you had held in the forest, and I converted it into a DVD, and I wanted to give it to you as my birthday present. And he gave me that video of that program. We all had to meet in the forest in Moscow, and it was usually the way they organized the programs is they would set up plastic, they would tie it in between the trees, and the devotees would come from different places from throughout the city, and they would come and they would change. Some of them would change into dhotis, and we held our program there in the forest, which was the meeting place. It was one of the regular meeting places where the devotees would go to have their programs, because it was still risky at that time to have programs in flats. There still were from time to time. Even at that time, it was during called perestroika. Perestroika was it literally restructuring? Perestroika? Restructuring, when the government was gradually restructuring, and glasnost, which is where they were becoming a little bit more open. But still, from time to time, devotees were harassed. So they had to have these different places for their gatherings. And we would sit, and sometimes when I began speaking, the lectures, they just wouldn't let me stop. The lectures would go on hours. Of course, you're used to six-hour lectures here in Mumbai. But I wasn't used to it, especially circumstances were such that in those days, because we didn't have auditoriums, everybody was packed together in a small, small, small flat, literally sitting elbow to elbow, knee to knee, back to back for, you know, in a flat like this, like for 6 hours straight. I mean, it's, of course, sometimes we used to stop after 3 hours and we would have our feast of boiled potatoes and bread. It was a feast. Devotees would get up, and I remember some of the feasts that we had. Of course, it was cabbage, cucumber, carrots, and potatoes. It's about all that was available during those days. Sabji meant potatoes and cabbage. That was sabji. And no spices. In fact, I remember one year, I don't know, am I going too far? I don't know. One year, I think it was 1992, maybe 93. I was diagnosed by, the doctors thought I had cholecystitis or something like that. And one Ayurvedic doctor's name was Vasant Lad. I met him in America, and he put me on a Khichdi diet. And for 6 months minimum, and it turned into a year. All I ate for a year was just Khichdi with no salt. And I was allowed to eat Khichdi and green vegetables like broccoli and asparagus. You know the story. Anyways, I had to travel because Khichdi was just not available. I had to carry 20 kgs of mung dal and 20 kgs of rice. Everywhere I traveled, that was part of my baggage at the planes. It was just mung dal and rice because you just couldn't get it anywhere. And in fact, this is a funny story. When the devotees were looking for green vegetables for me, I was in one city at the time. The city was Odessa. And green vegetables just didn't exist for them. But the devotees were so determined. One day, they went and they found broccoli for me. And they said, we found something for you, and it was called broccoli. And I said, where did you find it? They said, we got it at a botanical laboratory. They stole it in a botanical laboratory together. And not only that, they were so happy to cook it for me. And when they brought it before me, they brought me the stumps of the broccoli. And I said, this is broccoli? They said, yes. We cut off all those things on the outside. And they literally boiled the stumps, and they were a big smile on their face. Because they had no idea what broccoli was. It was just cabbage and potatoes. That's it. They never seen bananas before. You know, it's like. So then I said, you know, what did you do with the broccoli? They said, well, we cut all those things off. We thought they were useless. So they put them up in the garbage and they boiled the stumps. So, anyways, there are other stories I could tell, but I'm trying to set the scene, I guess, a little bit of what it was like in the austerities that were there during those times. It was the cold weather, the fact that I was being watched, and I had to be careful, the fact that I had to look like a tourist. And at the same time, I had a camera I wore around my neck. And I don't think I ever took it. There was no film in it. I just, I used to go around with all the other tourists of America just. I didn't want to waste the film on the Hermitage and all the other places. So I kept some film for taking pictures of the programs. But I didn't use it for when we were on tour groups. And the very first visit was, I said, I can't remember, it was in the winter of 1989. No? No, it wasn't the winter. Excuse me, it was the summer, because it included Janmashtami and Vyasa Puja. I was there. Summer of 1989. And the reason why I was invited to go to the Soviet Union is because I had a friend who was a wealthy businessman, and I had known him since the early 70s. He had been coming to our temple. In fact, he was one of Maharishi's top leaders in the Maharishi movement. Very top, like the top five. And he was once having a conversation with the Maharishi. And the Maharishi actually told him to help Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. So that was how he first came in contact with the movement. He was instructed by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi to help. And I'd known him since the early 70s. And he was in India in 1989, which was the first year that the Soviet devotees were able to leave the Soviet Union. They went to India. There was a very large reception of them. I think about 60 devotees went. He met them. And he was telling me some of his experiences and speaking with them. And he was so overwhelmed. He said, "Wouldn't it be wonderful if I could go to the Soviet Union?" So I said, "Why don't you go? Why don't you go? I'll see if I can make an arrangement for you." So he said, "I would definitely go, but I wouldn't go without you." I mean, same to me. So I contacted Kirti Raj Prabhu, who was then the GBC of the former Soviet Union. And I explained that I have one donor, charitable donor, who might be willing to help with the Soviet mission. And he would like to go, but he's asked if I would go also. So Kirti Raj, at that time, he invited me. But at that time, the only people who were visiting the Soviet Union at that time was just Gopal Krishna Maharaj, who went, first time he went was in 1976 to the book fair, Moscow book fair, and he brought Prabhupada's books there. And that was the famous story. I think that's when people were coming in and photographing the pages of Prabhupada's books. They would take one page to the next with their cameras and take pictures of the pages, yes? Yeah. And he was able to go to the Soviet Union. And Prabhavishnu Maharaj was going. And I think at that time, they were the only people that were going. It was very controlled. I think Indraduna Maharaj might have went also the same year that I went. He went also. He had to, I think there's a video of him standing in the Harinam with the devotees with a wig on taking pictures. He was wearing a wig. I grew my hair out. But yet the only way you could enter the Soviet Union is at that time was I had to grow my hair out. I had to take my neck beads off. I could not bring anything of any kind that would in any way, reveal who I was. And so I was told, even Kirti Raj told me not even to bring my japa beads. But I wasn't going to go without my japa beads, so I stuffed them in some clothes in a suitcase. And it was speaking about the first trip. I forgot lost. Anyways, the first trip, that's what it was like, and I went part of a tour. Charlie said, "I'll go," and so he bought tickets for the two of us. His name was Charlie. He bought tickets for the two of us when Kirti Raj agreed to let me go. He asked me a lot of questions and thought that I could be trusted. Charlie bought tour tickets. He arranged everything for the tours. And the tours were very expensive. And that's how I was able to go, because he sponsored my trips, some of the trips, usually about $5,000. To pay for the hotel, to pay for the flight, to pay for the in-tourist guides, to pay for the food. Of course, I couldn't eat any of the food with the tourists in the hotel because they didn't have anything for me to eat. And in fact, I used to have to sit with the tourists together, and because I had to look as part of the group, and the tourists we'd be sitting in the hotel and taking our meals together. And the only thing that I could find to eat was carrot strips and celery strips. Nothing else was offerable. Nothing else. Everything was meat and things. So I used to sit at the meals with the tour groups, and they'd be sitting and eating everything in the hotels, and I would sit there with a little glass of carrot strips and celery strips at every meal. And that made them very suspicious, what's wrong? And I told them I had to make up stories. I drank bad water. I was sick, something like that. But that was another obstacle I had to overcome, was being with the tour group and trying to convince them that I was one of them. So I had the camera, I had taking pictures, and I would go out with them on the tours. And then at night, at a prearranged time, I'd leave the hotel. So I wanted to speak about my first visit. In my very first visit, Kiriraj had already explained to me, he'd given me all of my instructions. He had a long sheet of paper of everything that I should be very conscientious about. No speaking in the hotels, no chanting in the hotels. Make sure you go on the tours. Make sure you don't get caught, leaving the tours. And when I first arrived in Moscow, very first night, my instructions were to go find a phone booth and to call a devotee named Krishna Kumar. I was given the phone number to call him and to set up a place and a time, because I couldn't call from the hotel. That's why I had to go look for a phone booth, to set up a place and a time where we would meet the following day in Red Square. So I just arrived from a direct flight from New York to Moscow. It was the middle of the night, and I left the hotel after everybody checked in and went to their rooms and everybody went to sleep. I left the hotel to go look for a phone booth. So finally, a couple of blocks away, I found a phone booth. And then I realized when I was at the phone booth that, wait a minute, I don't have any kopecks to make a phone call. So I didn't want to go back to the hotel, and there was standing next to me was a man who was on the phone, so I thought, I'll take a chance. So I tapped the man on the shoulder, and the man, looked a little startled and looked back to me, and it was my tour guide. Who came with me, not the Russian tour guide. He was the tour guide that came, but I didn't know who was who. All I know is he was my tour guide. He spoke Russian, and it was my first visit. And I was thinking, a first visit, and here I am at a phone. What am I doing at a phone? And I'm already caught by the tour guide. And the tour guide looks at me, and I can't remember his name. It's 30 years ago. I can't remember his name. He was American. And the first thing he said to me is, "What are you doing here?" And I didn't know what to say. I couldn't tell him, I'm not supposed to know anybody. I didn't know what to think. I just didn't know what to think. So I don't know why I said it. But I said to him, "What are you doing here?" And then he looked at me like, he looked at me like I must have looked at him. And I was trying to figure out what was taking place. And then he said to me, "I asked you first." Because I guess he didn't know who I was. And he looked worried. So I said, but I still didn't know what was going on. I just said, "What are you doing here?" I didn't know what else to say. I couldn't say what I was doing there. And somehow, I guess my determination to not tell him and to be look like I was being a little bit aggressive with him, he broke down first. And he said, "I'm a Jew, and I come to the Soviet Union to meet Jewish people as a tour guide." And he didn't say too much. I don't know why he said that to me, but that's what he said. He said, "I'm a Jew, and I come to the Soviet Union to meet Jewish people oppressed, persecuted in the Soviet Union." And he brings the medical supplies and things like that from the West. And he just told me who he was. So I said to him, then he said, "Okay, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm a Hare Krishna." He said, "Really?" I said, "Yes, my first time here." And he said, "Look, you don't tell anybody what I told you, and I won't tell anybody what you told me." I said, "What did you want?" I said, "I need a coin to make a phone call." So he was relieved, I guess, you know, to find, because I guess he must have thought that he was caught. So he gave me a coin and made a phone call. I went back to the hotel and went to sleep. And that was my first exposure in Moscow. And then the next day, I had to meet this devotee. His name was Krishna Kumar. No, I'm okay. I don't know, what should I do? When should I stop? Anyways, I met Krishna Kumar at St. Basil's Cathedral, I think it was. I was supposed to meet him under the sign. He didn't know what I looked like. I didn't know what he looked like. And but we made an arrangement that he would wear something that I would recognize. So I recognized what he was wearing. And we connected. And then, I don't know how relevant this is, I was very thirsty. And I said, "You know, before we go to the program, can we get something to drink?" And we ended up going to about at least 10 shops. And all the shops were empty because, you know, this is one of the reasons why communism fell, because it was just not providing even the most basic necessities for the Soviet people. We couldn't get water. Couldn't get water in any shop. Nothing. Nothing. 10 shops. After spending about a half hour going to different shops, and this is in a tourist area near the Arbat, which is a very famous tourist spot, I finally, in front of the hotel, what was the hotel that Prabhupada stayed in? National Hotel. In front of the National Hotel, there was a man with a Pepsi dispenser and a long line of people waiting to buy a cup of Pepsi from the dispenser. And we had to get in line for, he said, you know, Maharaj, this is the best I can offer you if you're really thirsty. You know, and we stood in line for maybe about 15 minutes to got a little cup of Pepsi. I was able to get something to drink. During those times, this is why communism was falling. So, even the most basic necessities. I remember even one day I came out of the hotel. This was also my first trip. I came out of the Hotel Belgrade in Moscow, and I saw a long line of people going around the corner. People were standing in line waiting for something. I was wondering what it was that they were purchasing. So I decided to go to see what it was. And every few minutes, somebody would come out with 3 bars of soap. That was it. That's what everybody was standing in line for, is to get their ration of soap, 3 bars. So many stories of that was going on at the time. But the devotee who met me, he said, Maharaj, we're going to go to Arbat, which was a street, it's a very popular street in Moscow. And he said, the devotees are there doing Harinam. Yeah. And he said, just don't talk. You know, because I guess the police were there watching us, but they weren't stopping us. They said, just don't talk. Just when you come, just get in the kirtan, and devotees, I'll ask you to lead the kirtan at one point. Devotees didn't know who I was. They thought, many of the devotees told me later, they thought I was just some brahmachari that came up from South Russia to join the Harinam party, because nobody knew I was coming into the Soviet Union. So we went to Harinam, and there was a huge group of people. Huge group of people standing around. The police were there, but they weren't stopping it at that time, at that particular time. I think the devotees felt a little, because of glasnost and perestroika, they were feeling a little emboldened, and thinking that, you know, because they really had a missionary spirit. I mean, one thing I can say about the Soviet devotees, they really had a missionary spirit. And so I went to the Harinam, and Krishna Kumara handed me a mridanga, and I started leading kirtan with my, dressed up in Western clothes, as a tourist. And after that, we left, and the devotees had arranged a program. That was the program in the forest that was arranged for me on the first day. And, you know, one of the things I did today, I've told stories before in the past, but this is the very first time I made some bullet points of different things. Because I want to make sure I got everything. Anyways, that's a lot of those things I've covered. My first trip was for 3 days. No, 3 cities, excuse me. It was for 9 days, I think. And I was accompanied by this sponsor. After doing several programs in Moscow, I continued with the tour group, and we went to Kiev. And then from Kiev, we went to Leningrad. In Kiev, And we arrived, it was Janmashtami day. And I had to do the usual of making my presence known on the tour with the tourists, the other tourists from America who had come. And by that time, our tour guide knew who I was. But he was only one part of the tour guide. The other part was the in-tourist tour guide who also traveled with us. And she was a young girl, but I was told the people they use as in-tourist guides and KGB agents, they're very unsuspecting. When you look at them, you'll never think they're agents, but that's why they use them that way. So I was warned, be careful, don't let the in-tourists catch you. So I had to continue, at least with the tour, and we had a program that night in a flat of a devotee named Amala Bhakta, who he was also had to spend many years in prison and was released, I think, just that year from prison. And when we arrived to do the program, it was late at night. It was a night program. One devotee, Achyuta Priya, he met me for the first time, and we went to Amala Bhakta's flat together. And when we arrived at the building was surrounded by police. And the devotees were up in Amala Bhakta's flat, and they couldn't come down, and I couldn't go in because Achyuta Priya and I, neither of us knew why the building was surrounded by police. We thought maybe they were there to catch me or him or them or whatever. So we pulled the car over and we just stayed there in the car. I don't know how long it was. It was a long time, hours. It was hours we had to stay in the car until finally the police left. And by that time, it was already very late at night. I think it was about midnight. And we went up to Amala Bhakta's flat and we had a program. And again, same, tight packed together in the flat. We had a Janmashtami feast, and I had an early morning flight to Leningrad the next morning with the tour again. And in Leningrad, I had to go with the tour group again. In Leningrad, I had to make arrangements to meet with a local devotee there, who had no idea what I looked like. I had no idea what he looked like. We had to meet at this place called the Battleship Aurora, which is Leningrad is filled with these canals. So it's the city of, I don't know how many canals there are. Anyways, he didn't know what I looked like, had no idea what I looked like. I had no idea what he looked like. And he came over, and I was parked in the car, and we didn't make a very good, somehow we didn't arrange things appropriately. So he just kind of stood on the sidewalk for a long time, looking in the car and trying to figure out if I was, and I was looking at him to try to figure out. And finally, after about 20 minutes of staring at each other, and he didn't speak any English, no English at all. And at that time, I didn't speak a word of Russian. So we didn't know how to really, and the person who was in the car with me didn't speak any English either. So that's why we just didn't know how to connect. But finally, he looked at me and he figured out that I must be the person he was looking for. So he got up enough courage to come over and tap on the window. And then he pulled down his collar and showed his neck beads. Finally, he got in the car, and then we drove off to outside the city. We had to go outside the city to a dacha. I think it was Sutapa's. This devotee Sutapa had a dacha in the city, and we had Vyasa Puja program for Srila Prabhupada that day. And again, it was a very wonderful program. And feast was cabbage and potatoes. And bread. One thing that I found out, though, the Soviet devotees at that time, whenever they had bread, I always used to say they had butter. Somehow they were able to get a lot of butter. They liked butter. Dairy products were available for somehow in abundance. And the devotees always used to like to have a little bread with their butter. I don't know if you caught it yet. They had so much butter on the bread that I used to say they would have a little bread with their butter. So that was the feast. It was butter and bread and potatoes and cabbage. And that was my first visit. But my realization from the first visit, maybe it was the first visit or the second, I went a few months later for a longer tour. My realization at that particular time was that I felt that what the communist regime had actually done is they had created a very fertile field for spreading Krishna consciousness, and the sincerity that the people had that I was meeting to hear about Krishna, it was so strong. Their desire was so strong. I just felt that it was because of their desire that Krishna was arranging to put me there. And Krishna was reciprocating with their desires, and I felt like I was just getting caught in the crossfire, you know, like they had such a strong desire to hear. Krishna wanted to reciprocate with their strong desire to hear, and somehow I happened to be at the right place at the right time, and Krishna was just reciprocating with their desires to hear. And otherwise, I don't know how I could have sat there under those circumstances, spoken under very austere circumstances sometimes, continuously for so many hours. And that was one of the things that I felt in my early visits in the former Soviet Union, is that the people there, unlike in America, where people's minds were very distracted by, you know, so many of the things that you know, were available in the West, which weren't available in the Soviet Union, that they had a great appreciation for books, they had a great appreciation for hearing, and their minds were not so much distracted by all the, you know, the things in the West, that for them to sit and to hear a lecture for so many hours, it was very natural. And sometimes I would visit people in their homes, and people, Soviet people, they would read. I mean, every place I went, there would always be a wall dedicated to books. They had big libraries. And it was a very fertile place for Prabhupada, you know, books to take root. And gradually, as I began going on different tours over the course of a couple of years until communism actually fell, communism fell, I believe, was in 1991. Was 91? Attempted coup? When was the attempted coup? Huh? Attempted coup was 91? I think it was 91. Yep, and I happened to be in the Soviet Union at that time. Kirtiraj Prabhu, and, yeah, it had to be 91 because we were in Begovia, They couldn't have been before. They had to be 91. The devotees said what they had done. They had found a abandoned building in Moscow. It was totally abandoned. And they decided to squat and take possession of the building. And that's what they decided to make as a temple. This is an abandoned building. And I was staying in that building with the devotees on that particular trip to the Soviet Union. And Kirti Raj Prabhu was there at the time. And the only two of us, two foreigners that were in the country at that time, was myself and Kirti Raj. And all of a sudden, when we were sitting in this building, we heard this very loud rumbling, very loud sound coming from outside. And Kirti Raj looked at me and said, "Maharaj, what is that?" And I said, "I have no idea." He said, "Let's go find out." And we walked out onto this big street, Khoroshovskaya Shose. It's a very wide street, and from the street was coming tanks and trucks full of soldiers. And they were all coming from outside the city. And it was very, very long, continuous line of trucks, tanks. And they seemed to be moving into the city of Moscow. And Kirti Raj looked at me and said, "Maharaj, this looks serious." And we thought maybe that the communists, we had no idea. We got on the radio, we listened to radio, tried to listen to Radio Free Europe, because one of the first things that was done is they took control of the communications, the media in Moscow, in Leningrad, and a few other cities. I can't remember. I think it was in Vilnius, in Riga. They took control of all the internal media, communication towers, and we didn't know what to make of it. And we tried listening to the radio. We couldn't get anything, what was going on. We listened to Radio Free Europe. It came from Sweden, I think it was. There was no mention. So he said, "Maharaj, we got to go find out what's happening." So we got in the car with a translator, and we followed all the tanks that were going into the center of the city. And this was the time when I think Yeltsin was standing on a tank, when it was the end of the Soviet Union. We didn't know at the time. We thought it was communism, that the communists were trying to take over the government again and take a complete takeover of the government. And the whole parliament building was surrounded by soldiers. The whole area was surrounded by soldiers, and people were demonstrating in the streets. Thousands and thousands of people were demonstrating in the streets, chanting Yeltsin's name. And we just didn't know, so we decided to go and talk to the soldiers themselves to see if the soldiers could tell us what was going on. We talked to the soldiers. We couldn't get a clear understanding of what was happening, and we couldn't have no access to the media. So after an attempt to find out what was going on, we went back and a failed attempt. We went back to the building where we had been staying, and we had to started to discuss about the potential consequences of a communist takeover again. I'm telling this story only because I guess it's at that particular point in time, we didn't know what was going on, and I didn't really fully understand what was going on. I definitely didn't fully understand what was going on. I had only been visiting the Soviet Union for 2 years. But Kirti Raj, because he had been associated with the Soviet Union since the late 1970s, and it was the GBC, he thought this was really serious. And he thought that if the communists take over again, everything that we're doing right now could be finished. And he said, I wouldn't say finished, but because even during communist times, the devotees were very effective and survived. But it could have been very dramatically changed. That much we were thinking. So Kiriraj turned to me and said, Maharaj, this is a communist takeover, it looks like to me. And they're going to close, first thing to do with a communist takeover, they're going to close all the borders. And that means there's only one direction. We can get out, but nobody will get in. And then he said to me, Maharaj, do you know what this means? I said, no. So then he said, what this means is that there'll be no leadership in the Soviet Union if this is a communist takeover, and we'll have to go back to what it was previously. And he said to me, he said, Maharaj, I have a wife and two kids. I can't stay. And then I realized what he was asking me. He was asking me if I would stay and go underground. And I didn't realize the consequences at the time. And I didn't really fully understand, except that what it meant potentially is that if I agreed to it, I was going to have to go underground and stay in the Soviet Union and never leave. And I don't know what, driven by what, I don't know. Because I could see Kirtiraj, who was the GBC at the time, was really pushing me for an answer. So I said, okay, if that's what I have to do, I'll do it. And then somehow the word got out to the local Soviet devotees, who always, they were always risking their lives. They were the ones who were risking their lives. They found out that I had agreed to stay in the Soviet, and everybody was talking about it. And you know, it was like they felt like they had a, you know, I couldn't believe that, you know, the way they looked at me, like, you know, like their hearts were just so grateful. But I didn't realize at the time what I had agreed to. I was thinking at the time, you know, like, yeah, I'll stay, and if I want to leave, I'll leave. But I didn't really understand the consequences, that basically it means that once I'm in, I'm in, and if I ever think of leaving, and if they, that's it. If I'm caught staying in, then I could be in where they were. And but anyways, it was, for them, it was very faith building that I had agreed to that. And then after some time, we found out that it wasn't a communist takeover. Needless to say, I was a bit relieved. but it took some time before we found that out. And devotees, as I said, they used to preach with such conviction. One devotee used to tell, who told me this story. In the Soviet times, when the devotees were in prison, one devotee was telling me, this was one of my early visits, he was telling me that when the devotees were in prison, this particular devotee, he was known to be a very, very, like, strong preacher. He was a very strong preacher. Under any circumstances, he would preach. I mean, this, like I said, these devotees really had a mission. They had a sense of mission. That was inculcated in their hearts, a very, very strong sense of mission, that this is for Prabhupada, this is for our spiritual master. Many of them had took an initiation in the late 1970s from Hare Kesh Swami at that time, although Hare Kesh Swami at that time was blacklisted. He couldn't come into the Soviet Union. He was caught in, I think, 1981 at a program in Riga, Latvia. And when they caught him, he had to leave the country. And they blacklisted him. He wasn't able to come in again for 10 years. But the devotees really, these early devotees who were initiated, they really had that sense of mission. And this particular devotee was telling me a story that when he was in prison in Armenia, that he said with the prison guards, one day they were coming, the prison guard came to him, and he started preaching to the prison guard, because he figured, why not preach to the prison guard? So he started preaching to the prison guard, and as he was preaching, the prison guard started running away. And he said, "Wait, where are you running to? Why don't you, just let me talk. Why are you running away?" And the prison guard was running, and he turned around, and he said to him, "I'm running away because you people speak with so much conviction. I'm afraid you'll convince me, and I'll be in jail just like you." So that's the kind of conviction these devotees had in the early days. They were ready, literally ready to risk their lives. And that's why I oftentimes say, when I hear me being introduced as a Soviet preacher, these devotees were risking their lives. I was just risking a little comfort, that's all, having to undergo some austerities. That definitely, there was not much comfort under those circumstances. I was staying in hotels, but those hotels was not much comfort at all. And even then, I was hardly ever in the hotels because during the day I was on tours. At night I was doing programs, and I had to figure out when to sleep. So this is a little bit of at least the early days of the Soviet preaching that I experienced. And then after the fall of communism in 1991, when communism did fall, then myself at that time, I think Baba Vishnu Maharaj, Gopal Krishna Maharaj, and Rohini Sutta Prabhu, I think. Was he? He was there. Huh? What time? 1990. Yeah, 1990. Yeah, so he was there in 91 also. Yes. So I think the four of us were requested to take responsibilities. Kirti Raj Prabhu, I oftentimes speak about Kirti Raj Prabhu as an unsung hero, because I know the sacrifices he made. Free the Soviet Hare Krishna campaign that he used to do. He spent so much of his energy, constantly meeting with people and also overseeing the preaching. I remember when he would come to India, he used to go to Delhi, to Connaught Place, and he used to meet Russian tourists, and he would try to get them to smuggle Bhagavad Gita's into the Soviet Union. And he had all these different arrangements he was constantly making to smuggle in the Prabhupada's books to get them into the Soviet Union. And he told me in 1991, he confided in him, he said, "Maharaj," he said, quite seriously, he said, I've given the last more than a decade, and I have two young kids and they don't even know who their father is." And he said, because he just gave so much of his life for the Soviet preaching, that he told me, he said, "I think I'm going to ask you and others if you can take responsibility now that the communism has fallen." And he asked if I would be willing to become a GBC along with the others that I mentioned. And we became GBCs, and it was ratified in Mayapur in 1991. And that's how I actually became involved in the Soviet preaching, because of this donor who would sponsor all my trips in the communist. He would pay for every trip. It was $5,000. And he would pay for me to go. And some of them he came with me. Sometimes he wouldn't come with me. And even when communism fell, he seeded a lot of the different projects in the Soviet Union, because during those days when communism fell, you could buy a building, a house for $1,000. So he went around to different cities where we were preaching, and he would seeded the different projects to get us started in the beginning days of when we could actually come out in the open and preach. And when we actually started to come out open and preach, there are devotees here, I'm sure, that can tell you stories. Indra Lakin could tell you stories of what the book distribution was like. I mean, during the days of those early days when communism actually fell, I remember I used to go out with the devotees and watch them distribute books. They had these tables, right? You remember the tables days? People, the only thing they had to do was they had to control the lines. People standing in line waiting to buy Prabhupada's books. And in Moscow, the devotees had even, they had all these different strategies to getting in the subways and the subway cars. They had these big posters and displays advertising Prabhupada's books in the subways, in the subway stations, in the subway cars. And people were just like, literally, you open up a table, put Prabhupada's books on the table, and most of the preaching had to be to control the people so they would stay organized and orderly to buy the books. That's how Prabhupada's books were. They would be sold in thousands, thousands, and thousands of books were being sold. And people were reading them. And I have a file. I have a file that I remember I got from the BBT. It was in 1992, maybe. I have a file filled with letters. Have you ever seen those letters from the BBT? They had the devotees, the letters people wrote to the BBT inquiring about Prabhupada's books. Have you seen them? You've never seen them? Amazing. Hundreds and hundreds of letters of people giving testimony of how Prabhupada's books completely, like the... how they've been looking for Prabhupada their whole life. And they give tell all these different little stories that would just melt your heart. How much appreciation the Soviet people had for what Prabhupada was giving. And this is what it was like. And as I said, my experience is that I wouldn't say so much that I was instrumental, but that I was just simply given the opportunity to bear witness to Prabhupada's preaching. That was somehow or other, I was given the benediction to be there and to watch Prabhupada transform people's lives. Still, so many years later, Prabhupada's desire, when he wrote in his concluding words of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he said that it is my desire that my disciples, you know, take responsibility for this Krishna consciousness movement and to spread it all over the world. It was Prabhupada's desire. In fact, I have it here. What exactly did Prabhupada say? He said, our society, International Society for Krishna Consciousness, has been formed to execute the order of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and His Divine Grace, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. That mood, that preaching spirit that Prabhupada had in service to his Guru Maharaj, that was impregnated in the hearts of his followers. And we were just somehow just instruments to Prabhupada's desire. He wanted to give Krishna consciousness, and he even said that, you know, that he, Prabhupada said when he met Ananta Shanti, he gave the example. He says that when he spoke to him for 2 days, he says, just like if you and takes up one piece of grain of rice out of a pot and you test that grain, he said, if it's cooked, then you know the whole pot is cooked. He said, similarly, from this one boy, I can understand that Krishna consciousness in the Soviet Union, that people are ready for Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada's books is what transformed the lives of so many people. He's continuing his preaching in his books and to his followers. And, of course, he wants to give... as Prabhupada said in Chaitanya Charitamrita, that Lord Chaitanya sent Lord Nityananda of Bengal to preach. He sent Rupa and Sanatana Goswami to Vrindavan to preach. And he can't remember who sent somebody else somewhere else to preach. And he said, and Lord Chaitanya left the rest of the world to the International Society of Krishna Consciousness. So it's in our hands. It's in our hands. Prabhupada wants it. It has to happen. We can either take part or not take part. But Prabhupada wants it. It has to happen. The nectar is in taking part. And that's the opportunity that Srila Prabhupada has given to us. So maybe I should stop there. And I thank you for giving me this opportunity. I could tell many little different stories, you know, about things that happened, KGB, and how I got caught once by an agent. But, huh? What's that? You want to hear that one? It's a short story. As I said, all the in-tourist guides, they were agents. We knew it. We were warned ahead of time. First one was a young girl named Yelena, but the second trip was this big guy named Anatoly. And I was out of the program late at night, and during those days you had to leave your passport and key to the room in the hotel. They always had the key on this big stick to make sure you don't take it with you, and to remember to turn it in before you leave, so that you would have to come to the desk and get your key, and you'd get your passports only when you were leaving the hotel. But that was one way they controlled you a little bit. So I came back from a late night program, and I went to the desk to get my key to the room, and Anatoly was waiting for me. And it was a very strange exchange. I knew who he was, and he obviously knew who I was. But he came up to me at the desk, and he looked at me, had this real mean look on his face, and he grabbed my scarf. And then he looked at me, and he took the scarf and he started tightening it around my neck. And he just looked at me and said, "What are you, an anarchist?" So I said, I tend to be a little independent at times. Why do I ask, you know? And then he said something like, can't remember his exact words. He said, "People who in the Soviet Union who wear purple and black scarves means that they're anarchists," which I found out later is not true. But he was just saying that to me. He's like warning me, like, "Be careful when you wear a purple and black scarf. We know that you're an anarchist." But just people, and he was tightening the. So I just said, "Okay, I'll remember that next time. I'll wear a purple and black scarf." And then he threw the scarf and faced my face and just said, "We're watching you. We're watching you." But that was it. It was my last night. Following day, I was actually leaving the Soviet Union, flying out. I can't remember to where. But I thought maybe I would be blacklisted. But I wasn't. I wasn't. That was my meeting with him, with the agent, but that was all that really happened. He didn't do anything. There are other stories other devotees had with their meeting with agents. I remember Prabhupada had this funny story. Prabhupada Maharaj. I think it was in Kiev. You know, it was very common that whenever somebody was visiting, the agents would follow. And we were always told, you know, when you leave the hotel, don't meet the devotees by the hotel. Always make sure you meet at a distance away from the hotel. In case you're being followed, at least they might not follow you all the way to where you're going to meet somebody in that way. And so Prabhupada Vishnu Maharaj, he told me this story, how he was once leaving the hotel, I think it was in Kiev. And he had to walk to meet the car. And the devotees knew that they used this particular tactic sometimes because they knew KGB agents were always following foreigners. So they brought two cars. So Prabhu Vishnu Maharaj got in the front car, devotee driver. And then in the car behind them, the two agents got in and they said, "Follow that car." But it was devotees. And so the devotees were driving the car behind the other car, and then all of a sudden, you know, they would take a turn, even though the other car didn't turn, they would turn the other, and they were hitting, "What are you doing? Follow that car! And the devotees knew their tactics, so they purposely were just, like, diverting. And remember that story. That was, again, that was during the communist times. There are other stories, but our encounters with agents at that time were not so treacherous. But it was a fact that, practically speaking, all the programs, they were there. They were watching. I mean, I remember I think it was even in maybe 94, 95. There was a festival. I stopped in Minsk for 3 days, and there was a young girl who was a KGB agent there for the festival the whole time, watching to make sure that I left the country. But she didn't say anything. I mean, she didn't stop me. She didn't, nothing like that. But that was, again, that was after the fall of communism. But they watch. They watch. And they know. They know who's coming to the country and for what. And they definitely knew during those days. But things have changed dramatically. Soviet Union, the face of the Soviet Union has changed dramatically since those early days. That is a whole story in of itself. Anyways, that's my story with encounter with a KGB agent. And I think you wanted to tell some. No?
Yes.
Okay. Hare Krishna. Thank you.